Hello, this is Mark Shanton for Theatre Voice, welcoming you to a critical discussion of two new plays in London and two musicals that have recently opened. Tom Stoppard's latest play, Rock and Roll, has opened at the Royal Court, where it is playing to July 15, before transferring to the West End's Duke of York's from July 22. Spanning the years from 1968 to 1990, from the double perspective of Prague, where a rock and roll band comes to symbolise resistance to the communist regime, and of Cambridge, where three generations in the family of a Marxist philosopher are under the spotlight, Brian Cox, Sinead Cossack and Rufus Sewell star in Trevor Nunn's production. At the New Ambassadors, on the third day, is the winning entry of an open competition to select the play of a previously unproduced playwright for West End production that was held under the gaze of Channel 4's television cameras for a fly-on-the-wall reality show, The Play's the Thing. Written by Kay Betts, a 51-year-old associate university lecturer from Chichester, it tells of an estranged sister and brother being reunited thanks to the interventions of a man who may be the reincarnation of Jesus. On the musicals front, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice's 1978 musical Evita, their final full-scale collaboration together, has returned to the West End in a new production at the Adelphi Theatre for the first time since the original production closed exactly 20 years ago. Michael Grandage directs a cast led by a genuine Argentinian actress, Elena Roger, in the title role. And the 2004 Tony Award Best Musical winner, Avenue Q, has crossed the pond at last, opening at the newly rechristened Noel Coward Theatre with a mostly British cast, joined only by Anne Harada from the original Broadway cast. With me to decide if these shows fly or fail are critics Charles Spence from the Daily Telegraph, Matt Wolfe of the International Herald Tribune, and David Benedict of Variety. Let's start with rock and roll. Does it rock and roll, David?
Well, as they say in all good football commentaries, it's a game of two halves, Brian. I found the first half completely impenetrable, without subtext. Some very nice acting, and it was pretty much unstaged. Well, it's not unstaged, that's a ridiculous thing to say, but it is a radio play, the first half. The second half blooms into a much stronger, richer, better, really good piece of Tom Stoppard theatrical writing, but I was pretty depressed by the interval. Now, this may be because I'm the wrong age and wrong generation, and I don't know my Czech politics, and I hadn't read the play before I went in. Afterwards, when I read the first act and I could see who people were, and I learned that, you know, pardon my ignorance, but I didn't know the Plastic Peoples of the Universe were a real band. I didn't know whether that was Tom Stoppard's invention. That's a very integral part of the play. I knew several of the names when they came up, but I didn't know who they were and how they related to anything and whether this was a peripheral person that was being spoken about or a very important person. So I was, it made me feel unbelievably ignorant, because I thought, I'm completely lost and I don't know how to read this information that I'm being given, don't know how to assess it. And then the second half, which is sort of heart, where the first half is head, that's a simplistic division, but it's sort of alluded to partly in the text. The second half, I was amazed at how good I thought the second half was.
Of course, the play reignites that Tom Stoppard passion for pop music, which was in The Real Thing as well. Charlie, as somebody who knows his pop music, did you have those problems?
Well, I was lucky enough to be able to read it before I went to see it. And I think actually what's interesting is his last few shows have been at the National. And Stoppard himself wrote very good programme notes for them, and particularly on Arcadia. The Royal Court programme has got a sort of bit of a sort of synopsis and a timeline and stuff in it, but it doesn't give you the information. I think actually that's worth saying what David said. And I remember I'm doing a bit of boning up on Wikipedia just about, you know, about Czechoslovakia in 68 and a bit about the Velvet Revolution. I think you do need some of that background, and it's fascinating to hear that you felt that absence. Having said that, I think the play is terrific. I don't think that Trevor Nunn's production is terribly good. It's on this tiny revolve. It's cumbersome. I think we've said quite recently about something else that it was Trevor Nunn at his worst, and here's another one of Trevor Nunn at his worst. It's too long, it's 3 hours 10 minutes, and it's a 2 hour 40 play if I ever saw one. But having said that, it really rocks in the most un-Stoppardian way, and Stoppard loves the rock music, but normally it's pretty cerebral, isn't it? But as that second half is probably the most passionate and painful writing Stoppard's ever done, I think. And I do think that the pop music and what's being said in the play ignites extraordinarily well, and that the main two performances from Rufus Sewell and particularly Sinead Cusack in two very emotionally raw roles are sensational. I think it's one of Stoppard's very best. Quite hard work at first, as David says, and I think it would be really helpful if they, when it transfers, they have a just a 1,000-word essay in the programme just to set it up.
Of course, it is a deeply personal play, isn't it, Matt? I mean, this, the fact that he came from Czechoslovakia, and it's the first time he's addressed that.
Not quite. He did write about similar things in Professional Foul on TV.
But I mean,
but yes,
I mean, what was interesting to me about it, I suppose, is we've not that long ago had a Mike Leigh play 2,000 Years, where for the first time in his career, he's sort of addressed head-on issues of Judaism, and that's interesting, since of course Mike Leigh is Jewish, but it's taken, you know, 5 decades for him to sort of come clean with that creatively and aesthetically. And here's Tom Stoppard, himself a Czech-born Jew, who has a character, Rufus Sewell's Jan, who is a Czech Jew. And it's interesting, you feel as if the play on some level is about the Tom Stoppard that might have been had he not stayed on, obviously, in Britain, which is his country. I completely agree with what Charlie and David have both said. I actually didn't like the first half at all, and I felt rather betrayed by the title, because the title seems to imply something very visceral and urgent. I mean, rock and roll, what could be more visceral than that? And I felt as if I was getting a lecture on rock and roll the way I got lectures on quantum mechanics and gardening theory and, you know, A. Housman's poetry and other plays. And I thought, of all things to do that with, why rock and roll? And then in the second act, it completely took off. I thought Rufus Sewell was absolutely extraordinary. I look forward to a next and probably better production of this, but I hope that Rufus Sewell particularly stays with it wherever it goes.
I mean, given the apparent clumsiness of the production that some of us have identified here, it's weird that they originally stated that it had to go to the Royal Court, it was written for the Royal Court. I wonder why that is.
Stoppard absolutely wanted to write a play at the Royal Court. It was the 50th anniversary. He'd never written for the Royal Court. He said before he died he wanted to do one. Now seemed the time, and the approach was made, and the Royal Court would have been fools to turn it down. But I think I agree with Matt. Actually, it needs a bigger production budget. I mean, although I would make a different assertion, in that I think, and I'm taking my life into my hands here by telling Tom Stoppard how to write a play, but I think that actually the first half is interesting as I read it and as I sort of understand it from my reading of the play, having sat through Bemused. I think the first half is actually completely wrong-headed, and you don't need the first half in order for the second half to work. I think that you could get across a lot of those ideas without doing a chronological trot through the life in Cambridge and the life in Czechoslovakia. You don't actually need that. There are other dramatic ways of presenting that material, and that the problem with trying to cut the play is, I bet it has actually been cut. But the thing is, what they've done is they've sort of removed some leaves, and actually what you need to do is lop a few branches off. I'm running out of things to do with that bad metaphor, but actually you need to completely rethink the structure rather than tweak it. And actually, if you sorted out how to convey the information dramatically in Act 1 in order that you can have the arguments and the emotional payoffs in Part 2, you'd have a dynamite play.
Except I think what I loved about the play, I thought it got terribly movingly, the passing of time and the damage of years, and also I loved the way Sinead Cusack was playing her own daughter, which would have to go.
I do think that
sense of mortality there was beautifully
But cool. I wonder if there's a way, and maybe it's just a different design, because the design is really dreary, but the first half needs awakening somehow, and it'll be interesting.
I'm really looking forward to going back and seeing it actually
at the Duke of York's. Maybe further playing in as well.
Yeah, it was a very strange first night. We had Rain Spencer, Di's mum, sitting next to Václav Havel. We had Mick there looking almost indistinguishable from Tom Stoppard when they're both sitting down. And
David Gilmour, Kate Blanchett. Yes,
it was a really great first night. And I think it was one of those very tense first nights. And also, I mean, certainly if you were reviewing it on the night, it was a bloody, Stoppard plays always are a nightmare. But, you know, is that sort of, and just, I'm looking forward to being able to watch it again and relax.
I've never read reviews that have mentioned as many people in the audience as before as this one. I mean, you guys had it lucky, though, if you said it ran 3 hours 10, because I went to the very first preview when it ran 3 hours 45.
Almost. That's Trevor's ideal lump, next, isn't it? That's
for
the
everything. His A-Jo will be 3 hours 45 minutes. Yes.
But I do think it's worth echoing what Charlie and Matt said. I think that's my performance of the year, Rufus Sewell.
Yes,
absolutely astonishing. In the last act, where he breaks down with sadness at everything that's happened in his life and betrayals that have happened to him and the man he's believed in, it's extraordinarily moving, and you sit there going, okay, he's playing someone who's aging from something like 15 years younger than him to 15 years older, and it's utterly, utterly plausible. And Sinead Cusack, particularly playing her own daughter, manages to give you this incredibly fey surface of this sort of wispy, rootless woman who's still somehow the girl she was, though we saw another actress play her. And yet, beneath all that surface, she gives you someone who's got heart and unfocused intelligence. It's a very fine performance. Yeah.
There's something very moving when you see an actor kind of perpetuate a career with a playwright. You see directors and playwrights do that all the time, but it's very nice when actors do that. In America, that's happened a lot with the work of August Wilson, who, of course, writes so brilliantly for the black theatrical community there. But I thought it was thrilling, 13 years after Arcadia, in which Rufus Sewell was magnificent and unsurpassable as Septimus, to then see him again shine in a stoppered play.
I mean, yes, really, and the great quality he's got is a very Stoppardian one, isn't
absolutely
it? He's got charm, and there is something about him where he feels like the author's mouthpiece.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? I mean,
he's also not forbidding, which is very helpful.
Very, very
he
welcoming.
Invites you in.
Invites you in, exactly. Mm. Lovely warmth to him. Mm. I think it's a lovely performance.
And he doesn't do a lot of work. I mean, yes, he's doing a lot of work.
Yes.
But you don't see
him. You're not aware.
You don't see, he's not showing you his working.
Even with the accent, which could make a big deal out
of it. His accent work is absolutely astonishing.
Superb.
Because it gets more check the longer he stays in the country that he returns to. It's amazingly
lovely performance.
When rock and roll transfers to the West End, it will be one of the very few brand new plays playing in the West End. The only other brand new play is On the Third Day, which has been found by this TV programme. Did they find a hit or a miss, Charlie?
Well, I kind of liked it, but I'm a bit of a sucker for sort of eccentric religious plays.
Being an eccentric religious man yourself.
Yes, I suppose so. But it's a kind of mad choice for a West End play, and it makes you think, if this was the best, what were the other 2,000 like, the entrance for it? But what's really odd about it is that two of the judges didn't seem to like it either. From what I saw of the programme, the literary agent Mel Kenyon and the actor Neil Pearson both were extremely rude about this play, and Sonia, obviously, as the producer, just had her wicked way over them and said, yeah, I'm having this one.
But I get the distinct impression that the others were as unstageable, and this was probably the one least likely to be difficult to actually produce.
Oh, right.
And also it's the one that had the champion behind it. I mean, Stephen, they apparently farmed them out to certain directors, and Stephen Plumlodge championed this one. And then, of course, sadly had to withdraw. So that kind of threw out.
Although it does seem on the television series as if the play by Steve, the guy who stacks supermarket shelves, right, seems to be the one that's going to win and doesn't.
Yeah.
So that's a bit of a surprise.
Mm. I mean,
I'd like to see his play somewhere.
Well, I mean, certainly the process of the choosing is very odd. I mean, they didn't submit entire plays. They submitted a scene and a synopsis, which is no way, as we know, to judge a play.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the two lucky ones are the runners-up, because they're going to have their plays done at some point, I'm sure, without all that horrible exposure.
Yes, I feel sorry. I mean, it's
you're
no
throwing
way
her
to,
in the deep end.
It's no way to start a career, this, and I don't think it was particularly good television either.
No.
I think it was terrible television, because there was no jeopardy that we could recognise.
No.
If you watch Pop Idol or American Idol or any of them, you see the people doing the thing, and then you disagree or agree with the judges because you've seen it. Whereas I know somebody that turned down this program to work on because they argued, well, where are the pictures? And indeed, where were the pictures? You can't film somebody writing a play. You can film somebody rehearsing a play. That might be interesting.
The jeopardy on television, actually, which I'm not sure means anything to the great unwashed public, quite rightly, is Sonia Friedman, the producer, getting in and out of a hell of a lot of taxis and taking first-class trains here and there. Great.
I thought she looked hilarious. She looked more and more neurotic in every shot than she had.
Yes, and will her sort of faith and investment and everything else go rewarded? Well, that's fine. It has very little to do with Kate Betts.
No.
But it's also, it seems to me, to be very little to do with theatre writing. You can actually write a novel and get it published, and they could have set up a competition. It wouldn't be televisual, but you could set up a competition to go, we want to get people to write a novel, and actually all you have to do to write a novel is read a lot of novels and type. And actually, some of them might turn out to be good, whereas learning what makes a play work in front of an audience is a very long and elaborate procedure that is to do with you having experience working in a theatre and watching what happens in rehearsals and finding out what a director does, finding out what actors do. And that seems to me to be destined to failure. Channel 4 insisted that these are novice playwrights. So most people were writing dialogue off telly, because that's where most people see dialogue. And telly dialogue is not theatre dialogue.
But that's, in a way, what's interesting interesting about the play that was chosen, Kate Betz's play, is that it certainly thinks outside the televisual box. I mean, for heaven's sake, it reaches to the stars, quite literally.
The design challenge
and then
is huge.
It burrows underground. And actually, as a production, I mean, just as a production, it's, I think, more interesting than Rock and Roll. I mean, it's very nicely designed and very well directed.
Every first playwright should have their play designed by Mark Thompson.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an extraordinarily fine design. And actually, if you sat there and thought, let's just do a reading of this in a black box, there's no there. There's a lot of talk and very little drama.
What I thought was quite moving about it, in a way, actually, was the commitment brought to bear on it by the theatre practitioners.
I thought they gave it a
That was actually very, very touching. There was no sense of, well, she's not a very important playwright, so we'll just kind of, we won't work hard on this one. We'll save our things for Mark Thompson doing the next Arcadia, Arcadia Part 2. None of that. It was taken for real.
And some serious stage writers. I mean,
some lovely acting.
The three performances are really, really,
really good.
I think we've been a bit hard on it, and I think it was an ambitious play. I think it was a deeply felt play, and I think it had glimmers of real talent in it. And had we seen it at the Bush and known nothing about it, I think we'd have found it a very exceptional debut.
And even in terms of plays that end up on the West End, I've seen far worse by writers who are very established, like Embers, I'll go on the record saying. So, you know, I think some of the critics have come down unduly harshly on this, and it's not really Kate Betz's fault. She's a victim of a system which isn't even a system.
It's a stunt. She's basically being caught up in a stunt, and it's not going to do anyone.
And I hope she keeps writing.
And they could have done for the same price. They could have launched 10 dramatists with
and given them workshops and development, and done shows at the Bush. Because the point is that actually, the whole thing was bogus in that. Opportunity, the opera series found a checkout assistant and a blind mother and got them to a point where they sang at the Coliseum. Yeah. It was incredibly moving. It was fantastic television. Yeah. And it must have made their entire lives make sense. That sounds patronizing, but it was a fantastic thing that they could never have otherwise done because of the years of training and the difficulty. Actually, if any of us around this table wanted to change our names and submit a play, we could get it on if it were halfway good. Wouldn't be in the West End, but you could get it on either on BBC Radio 4, which takes over 400 plays a year, or at the Bush, or at Soho, or at many, many other places in London where people like us can review it. But they take plays by people that have been on the development process. This was taking people, as it were, off the streets. The chances of that yielding anything really good was tiny.
Or alternatively, we could all audition for Maria in The Sound of Music, which is also the way they're finding a new Maria. Just as well they didn't do that for Eva Perón, I think. They seem to have trawled the world and gone to Argentina and found Eleanor Roger. What did you think of her, Matt?
I thought she was terrific. I mean, I have to say, everyone's saying, oh, well, of course she was great because she was Argentinian. That makes absolutely no sense. That's like saying that any American actor is great in Tennessee Williams because he's an American playwright. So the fact that, oh, she's Argentine, therefore she has to be wonderful. No, she's wonderful because she has a very specific quality which suits the role very well. In fact, I think, to be honest with you, having seen the original production on Broadway, Never in London, with Patti LuPone several times, she misses some things. I mean, I miss the kind of sheer vulgarity that Patty brought to the role and a kind of wonderful, wonderfully self-knowing camp, which I think the musical itself has. This is a very serious, po-faced, deliberately operatic production of the show. But that's fine. You know, that's the tack that Michael Grandage and Chris Sorum and particularly Polly Constable have taken. And that works very well. And Elena slots beautifully within that. And it's riveting.
Indeed, it is a very, very different production to Hell Prince's one. I mean, Hell Prince's production was kind of iconic and has been very difficult to replace. Well, how did you think Grandage solved that?
I only saw the original. I saw it several times, the original. I never saw it with Elaine Page. I was the one who used to have to cover the takeovers. I saw the rather less distinguished line of less distinguished Evitas going into this role. But I did see Harold Prince's production, and I found it, at the time, I found the show rather flashy and Brechtian and sort of rather pleased with itself, and really wasn't terribly persuaded by it. This staging I found absolutely riveting. I thought it concentrated on the story. I thought it had a sort of depth of feeling in it. I thought it was very interesting, the ambivalence with which they portrayed Evita, you know, that she was both sympathetic and an absolute monster, and your reactions to her kept changing all the way through, which is actually exactly what Tim Rice's best ever lyrics bring out about the character so well, I think. I thought it was a really successful evening. I wasn't expecting to enjoy it nearly as much as I did, and I came out bowled over. And as you say, this new Evita is something special. And she's tiny, and she's got this strong voice, and biggest mouth you've ever seen, and just fantastic, I thought.
She actually reminded me quite a lot of Patti, though, in her wide mouth. And even her indistinct lyrics sometimes.
yes.
David, what did you think?
Well, I pretty much agree with Charlie. I came into this as pretty much an Evita virgin. I'd stood on the set when I auditioned many thousands of years ago, and that was the closest I got to the original production. I saw the movie, which I thought was literal flat and boring, and so my expectations were pretty low, I suppose, I thought there must be more to this than the Alan Parker movie is letting on, otherwise, you know, how come it would have run for so long in London, and why would Grandin and Oram want to do it? You know, I'm sure they've been offered plenty of things that they've turned down. This one they decided to do. And then 15 minutes in, you realise why they took it, because 15 minutes in, we've had her as the peasant. She goes to Buenos Aires. The back wall flies out. You get this monumental set of an unbelievably beautiful square in Buenos Aires, and it's all lit from the windows within by Paulie Constable. It kind of glows. And on the stage, you have an entire company dancing as if their lives depended upon it, and you get Elena Roger, who looks like she's just been lit from within by her own ambition and her own excitement. She's thrown from person to person in Rob Ashford's superb choreography, and she looks absolutely driven by ambition and delight and the knowledge that she's going to succeed. And the whole song is about her having star quality, and you go, yep, you absolutely do. And that's the first button in the show at the end of that number. And the crowd goes nuts. Yeah. Because you go, I completely believe that you are going to set out to achieve everything that you do. So you're completely connected with her. And then, as Charlie says, the show very, very, very carefully keeps switching your position over what you think she is doing. The show was roundly criticised by arch social realist Michael Billington, The Guardian, for not taking sides and not telling us that she was a bad thing because she was a fascist. Well, the truth is we don't actually know what her motives were. And this show keeps you interestingly, dangerously in doubt. And that's a real achievement in musical theatre, I think.
Yes, there's just that slight whiff of the jackboot about it all, which adds something to it, I think. There's no doubt about it. There's gives that very odd aura. And I think that's what's so fascinating. I absolutely disagree with Billington on that. The whole point is that it doesn't make that final judgment. And that's what makes it so fascinating for the viewer.
And it does what musical theatre can do. If I wanted to go see a lecture about how the Perrons rose to power and what they did, I'd go to a lecture or read a book. Musical theatre allows you to use imagination and to inhabit ideas simultaneously in different ways, because you see things happening in front of you that create conflict. When she's giving out all the money, for the money keeps rolling in, she's looking mean as hell whilst distributing all this largesse. It's a really complicated moment because you don't know how to respond. Good that she's giving money away, but is she doing it to launder her conscience? You don't know. And the number keeps both those ideas afloat.
There's one very interesting thing, too, I think, for people who follow directing, which is that, and I'm sure everyone around this table has been aware of this, usually when British directors come to do something that American directors have done, what the British director does, usually very successfully, is abstract it. So the number of productions of Williams or O'Neill or Miller, whoever, that I've seen in this country where something has been quite literal in the States, and here it's sort of stripped bare or, as I say, abstracted. This does the opposite. Hal Prince took a very abstract, conceptual, showman-like approach to the show, not big on character, very big on tableau, virtually no set except for black scaffolding and a black stage floor. And what Michael Greenwich has done rather unexpectedly is made it real. He's made it literal, but not in the negative sense of literal. He's gone to Argentina. He's fleshed it out. He's given it a place. He's given it a focus.
He's given
fascinating.
It heart, aren't they? Which I
and he's given it drive. He's taken every other musical I think I've ever seen is desperate to win applause at all times. So they put a button on every conceivable moment. they take out every button in the show except three. There's only three points which the audience can applaud.
Yes.
They drive it through, which also flatters. Whilst I think, yes, it's Tim Rice's best lyrics, I don't think it's his best book, because it's like an oratorio. I mean, it's not an opera at all. It sets up a scene, and then there's a cavernous gap between the scenes, which used to be covered by applause. The applause is got rid of. The narrative drives through. So it now it's like a Peter Schaffer play. You now get things juxtaposed, which look like an argument. They aren't at all. but you're driven through, so you're absolutely kept aware that there is character and motive driving.
Of course, if it were a Peter Schaffer play, there would be a moment where Eva Peron sheds his clothes and Shay would go running towards him.
One thing I would like to say is it seems to me that Grandage is a smashing director, and we all love him, and you know, he does wonderful work, but I was slightly disappointed by that Guys and Dolls he did, which didn't seem to me to be a great production of a great musical. I'd say Evita isn't quite a great musical. It's
nearly a great musical, but
it's not quite, but it's a very fine musical, and he's made it seem like a great one here.
I absolutely agree. I think for a large amount of it, you feel like you're watching A-list material. It's only when you come out afterwards you go, hang on a minute, no, but I was persuaded in that. I mean, there's very little that anybody can do with the last, probably, quarter of the show, which is... And then she died. But it does what it can.
Yeah. I mean, Aurum, I think, gives it lots of colour, which is unusual for him, because he usually does
think in terms of colour.
And Ashford, as you said, David, I mean, it gives it a lot of movement. It's interesting, the original production had a billing, a musical staging by Larry Fuller. This one actually has a choreography credit, because the movement is threaded through the whole show.
Yes, I mean, and it becomes the actual vocabulary of the entire show. So the General's number is done as a kind of lethal tango. The number, I'd Be Surprisingly Good For You, gorgeous new Latin American arrangements. Lloyd Webber went into a studio and just spent a day listening to people from South America play music and absorb the orchestration, and has now rewritten the score to suit that. All those tango numbers are used as story tone devices. They're not about dance numbers. They're about how can we use dance and movement. When you think of Argentina, you think of the tango. So that's what the show is now doing, so that it uses that, as I say, not as dance breaks, as sort of to kind of break up the narrative, but to actually hold the narrative together. I think it's an extraordinarily successful piece of teamwork by lighting, sound, dance, movement, everything. It's all absolutely of a piece.
It's masterly, really, isn't it?
And they've also brought in the new song from the film. And finally, to Avenue Q, a huge hit in New York, but has it survived The Crossing, David?
I'd not seen it. I made a policy decision that I would not listen to the cast album. I was not in New York when I could see it or whatever. So I went to this as an Avenue Q virgin. All I'd heard was the buzz from 4 weeks of previews, which was extraordinarily good. I liked it, had a wobble, where I thought, I think this is too schmaltzy, and then I sort of fell back in love with it. It's not the most radical show in the world. What's radical on Broadway and what's radical in London are completely different things. I think an audience that's been fed Jerry Springer isn't going to view Avenue Q as being daring and different. On the other hand, I do think that it's a rather unique piece, and it's kind of brazenly funny, and I rather enjoyed it.
Charlie, you only saw it in New York. You haven't seen it here yet.
Yes.
Did you enjoy it in New York?
I did kind of enjoy it in New York. But even as I was writing my review saying I'd rather enjoyed it, I thought, this is not a show that's ever going to go down in England. And I do hope it doesn't come over, because everyone's going to remember my review and think that I've gone bonkers. It's the sort of show that there's something about the New York theatre that you kind of open your arms to just... that schmaltz and, smiling through the tears and the cutes, which you very much get with these puppets. And I imagined that it wouldn't work very well here. And interestingly enough, my colleague Dominic Cavendish, the founder and great boss of this Theatre Voice itself, he gave it a very sniffy review in The Telegraph and didn't like it at all. Have we sort of explained that it's a mixture of people and puppets properly?
I was going to say, I unashamedly adored it in New York and fell in love with the cast album there, and have to say I've repeated my love here, but then I am very much an Americanophile on that. I mean, it is the essence of New York show, in its sensibility, in the I was worried about it transferring here too, but as David said, during the previews, it got a very good buzz. The interesting thing I think about that is that the preview prices were £10 to £30. They were deliberately pegged lower in order to get a youthful audience in to start spreading the word. Whether or not that audience stays with the show now that the tickets are up to £50, it's a seven-man show, plus a small band of six, 13 people in all. Whether or not that is worth £50 when you can get Ibiza for £50.
There is an incredibly wide price ticket range. I sound like I'm in the pay of Cameron McIntosh, but there is a very, very wide ticket range on this. There is a top, I think, of 45.
No, 50 on weekends. And there is a bottom price, it is true to say, of £10.
And several prices in between, whereas in New York there's sort of two ticket prices and there's four seats up the back that are cheap and the rest are all $100. I don't think the price resistance... I don't think that's the problem. I do think that there is something about watching basically the Muppet Show live, for those that haven't yet gleaned what it is we're talking about. It's kind of that. It's a story about everybody living on Avenue Q in Brooklyn and aspiring to a life and the fun they had. And it's satirical about American mores and delights and fears. And there are songs like Everybody is a Little Bit Racist.
Is it the one I like? Because people are only on the internet in order to watch.
The internet for porn.
There are
really nice lyrics about get out your dick and double click and all that kind of stuff, and which is not what people expect of a musical. I think that if every musical I saw were like this, I'd have a problem. But actually, I don't quite understand the opprobrium that's been heaped upon it by most of the Daily critics, who seem to have had a major sense of humour failure on this, who are sort of get angry that it isn't harder satirical. It's not trying to be Jerry Springer. It's not trying to be even Spitting Image. It is what it is. And actually, it has a kind of gleeful charm. And there's a number that Christmas Eve has, and you'll have to tell me what it is in the second half, where you think it's going to be the, oh, God, when people love you.
The Judy Garland number.
There's a torch song, but it's about hating and wanting to kill. When you love someone, you want to kill them.
Yes.
And it's very, very funny.
Yeah.
And also, it has better lyrics than anything in the West End, probably apart from Sunday in the Park with George, which people seem to be taking for granted. I mean, I'm sorry, but those lyrics are witty. We don't get wit in musicals. You get big tunes and indeterminate moon, June, croon, spoon lyrics.
Something about the British critics. I mean, there's quite a lot of them that don't like the musical full stop, really. You know what I mean? Amongst the national critics. I think there's a big problem with musicals. Some people just don't get it. And the other thing is, I think that they're very suspicious of charm, and which is, I think, something that audiences tend to like a lot. And critics are always very suspect of.
I'm very, very suspicious of smarm, and I was worried that this had it. And actually, I don't think it does. I think it's rather fresh and rather winning. And as I say, I don't think it's profound. And maybe it would have been better if this had grown from somewhere smaller, and there would have been a kind of different feeling behind it.
There was originally that plan to open it at Stratford East and then bring it in, which, of course, in New York it had opened at the Vineyard and then transferred to Broadway.
Why did they not do that, which would seem to me to have been very good for Stratford East and a great way to bring the show in?
Well, except that you could argue that they sort of did that by doing 4 weeks of preview in town with the top price of 30, and 70% of their business is being done on the internet. There is a groundswell behind this. It may well be...
So might it survive these bad reviews, do you think?
Well, I personally hope so. I mean, the show reminded me a lot of was another puppet musical that Cameron McIntosh, in fact, did 25 years ago, Little Shop of Horrors. He originated it off-Broadway and also featured a singing plant puppet. And it was similarly fresh. Howard Ashman and Alan Menken wrote were a new team around then. And they wrote this brilliant, refreshing score. Yeah. These two guys, Bobby Lopez and Jeff Marks, are similarly, on the start of something. I mean, I worry that I don't know where their next show is going to come from, because they may well have done the show they always wanted to do now. But I absolutely adored it.
The only thing I'd say is that it closed in very short order also in Las Vegas, which was a surprise to many.
Well, except that I think that it is so not what people want from a Vegas show. You know, this is kind of down-homey. The set is deliberately down-homey. You know, some little nice gags happen on the set, but it isn't splendid and splashy. There's no water, there's no fire. I mean, you know, you'd sit there going, what on earth is this, if you were geared up for the Las Vegas experience? I think that this deserves to do well. I think if it can survive the next 3 months, if there's enough, if they can keep it floating for the next 3 months, word of mouth might save it. This might do in London what Wicked did on Broadway, slammed by the critics, now taking 1.4 million a week. They're laughing.
And on that note, thank you, Matt, Charlie, and David.